Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilek, and Sujit Mallow, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com. Welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 195, being recorded on the 13th of September, 2017, with special guest Vishwas Lele. I'm Sujit, and on Skype with me, I have Evan and our special guest. Unfortunately, Kale is in Scottsdale, Arizona, in an offsite meeting.
You know what that means, right? That means he's out drinking right now.
Yeah, that's
having
right.
a good time, right? They met for a couple of hours during the day, and then they're partying
for right.
the night.
The offsite, yeah, I know what that means, yeah. good for him anyways. I know he's been working hard and probably deserves a little bit of a break. I did hear from some of our internal folks, though, that who also are big listeners of the podcast, is there's apparently this big demand for more blockchain topics on the podcast.
Oh, golly.
Yeah. Like, we haven't talked about that enough already, but they actually want, you know, like a full episode on it, just like we did that developer episode a while ago. So apparently that's someone's going to talk to me about that soon, so it's going to come down.
we should make sure to do it one of the days Kale's not around.
Not around, yeah, and confuse everybody about blockchain. But yeah, I've seen that Mark Resnovich has been putting out a lot of videos on the Cocoa framework, so I think that's something we can touch on. That seems to be the hot framework these days.
Yep.
Okay, so before we get to our special guest, Vishwas, who has been on the show before, and we thank him for coming again, talk about some really cool topics. So let's just quickly run through some of the updates this week, Evan. Thanks for putting that out in the show notes. Is there one that you want to start with?
Well, since Kale's not here, I have to represent for database stuff. Uh-huh. I actually thought this was really neat. So we've partnered up with, I guess it's Attunity. I'm not 100% sure how to pronounce it. But we partnered up with them because they've got a product called Attunity Replicate. And what they're actually able to do is take the data from, from one of the open source databases, MySQL, Mongo, those kind of things, and move them into SQL Server on-prem or into the Azure Cloud, so Azure SQL DB. Right. Mm-hmm. And so, somebody, again, that's always been the problem, right? Because even with the open source databases, once you're in, you're kind of locked in.
Right.
Right. And again, I'm all for open source. I'm all for going, being able to go back and forth. But in this day and age, right, with as fast as technology is changing and stuff, to be able to move between them easily is nice. Right. So there's a webinar coming up on the 21st. We'll put the link in the show notes as well. But it's a nice feature.
That's great, yeah. And this, I don't know, it doesn't say here, but this may be related to the, SQL Server managed instances, right? Or
yeah, it wouldn't surprise
Cloud
me as well. Yeah.
Yeah, because that seems to be the most convenient way to move some of these applications, to get SQL Server running in Azure and have all the power of SQL Server,
Yeah, yep.
Okay, so the one that I liked, of course, was the, and I'm glad they finally did this, which is now the Azure Blobs files, tables, and queue storage is all encrypted by default. Encryption at rest is on by default, which I think is really great, and there's no additional charge for it. And on top of that, they say there's no overhead to it either, performance-wise. So kind of a win-win thing. Your data, you can rest easy now that, no pun intended, that all your data at rest is encrypted, so nobody can look at it.
And this is for existing accounts. We are backporting this. I mean, it's not on like this very second. Like, we're rolling it out as we go. But every account will get it, even existing ones, right?
Right. Yeah. This is by default. Everything that's I don't know if you already have data, if they're going to go back and re-encrypt everything, you recall in the past you had to actually turn on a flag, right, that said, I want this encrypted. And now it's by default it's encrypted.
My guess, thinking through this, my guess is that we've changed the API so when you write something, it gets written decrypt in an encrypted fashion. And so I suspect you have to touch your stuff, but
At least once, yeah.
yeah. You know, I mean, if you really, I mean, I guess if it was super, super critical to you, just go through and touch all your things and then you're done.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Cool.
Neat.
Yeah. And then I like this update on the Azure Active Directory domain services, which I think that was a long time coming, right? Where you could now.
That is one of the most, so my current team supports that, right? And that is one of the most frequent requests we get. And it actually causes some of the most confusion, especially now where we've got this whole classic portal, where the classic portal is really starting to go away. And so it's a little confusing, when, because you might still manage your classic network in the new portal, but you still got to go to the old portal to see Azure Active Directory Domain Services. So yeah, this is great to see this feature coming.
Right, and this kind of brings up another topic that I'd like to just touch upon is, I think a lot of customers expect all our services to be part of virtual networks, right? They all have their own virtual networks, and they say, oh, why can't I have XYZ service in my virtual network? And as you know, not all our services are supported in virtual networks. Like for example, Azure Active Directory is not VNet joint, right? Whereas the domain, this one, this particular offering that we just talked about, the domain service is. And I get the feeling that over time, a lot of them will be eventually merged.
Well, I think it depends on the type of service, right? Something like, so like, talk about like web apps, right? Web apps, we've got the application service environment, I think is, I forget what the S stands for.
App services environment, or now known as app service isolated, now the new name.
But like those deploy into the VNet as actual VMs in the VNet. So those are super easy, AD domain services, same thing. But like some of the things I know, and I'm not going to go, I'm not 100% sure if they're public, so I'm not going to go into the details, but I know some of the PaaS services we're looking at creating, the ability for it to look like it's in the virtual network, right? But like some of these services like AAD, I don't know. That's going to have to be some implementation on that, like some sort of proxy type implementation, because it's like there is only one instance of
Exactly. It's a shared
AAD.
thing, yeah. Yeah. And that's where the whole brings up the whole thing of shared services, right? Cosmos DB is another good example, which and then Key Vault, which is what I'm actively working on these days, is again, it's not a VNet joint. Yeah, I think over time they're coming up. I know what you're talking about, Evan. There's some work going on behind the covers at the network layer in Azure to enable this, but we don't know when that's going to happen, so we won't say anything here. So that's a good roundup of all the news this week, and I think we can turn the mic over to our special guest Vishwas, who, as I mentioned, has been on the show before, so a lot of our listeners might remember him from our previous discussion where he talked about his the work that he does as an MVP and a regional director and all the speaking engagements and et cetera that he does. And as a matter of fact, he is going to be speaking at some shows coming up. So I'll let him talk about that. Vishwas, go ahead. Can you give us a quick intro?
Sujith, thank you very much for inviting me back. I continue to do the same things that I was doing when I appeared on the show the last time, but having a lot of fun as you just talked about the new services that are coming up. It's hard to sort of slow down with the cadence of releases
I
that we
know.
have in the cloud. And we've changed the industry forever with the cadence of release.
It is exhausting at times. It
It is.
really
It is.
is.
It is exhausting at times, and you have to find ways of, focusing on the things that are most important for the projects that you're working on. But at the same time, you have to keep an eye on what is coming so that, maybe there's a big change that you could take advantage of, which will make a big impact on your project. So it is challenging and exhausting, as you said.
But it's fun, right? It really is neat to see the stuff that's coming and be able to play with it.
So, yeah, you know, we've just come to, you know, we hear about these new capabilities and, you know, the first question is, hey, how can we access the service? There must be a public preview. Even if it is not GA, I can play my hands and get my hands to it. If not, can I just get a private preview? And, you know, the ability to get access to these features very quickly is the exciting part, but that's can also become an exhausting part.
I mean, think about it, you know, it's exhausting for us sometimes too, because we have to write, you know, figure out, offer guidance and things like that. But think about people like Evan and all, right? They have to support all these different things. Like literally every day he wakes up, he's probably got something else on his plate that he has to worry about. You never know what the customer is going to call with.
I would say, I used to say when I, you know, at the, you know, when we new hires came in, I said, hey, it's going to be a year or two before you even understand what whoever's calling you is asking about 90% of the time, right? That's just the reality. In this cloud world, like I've been doing this for a long time and I'm thrilled if 80% of the time I actually knew that you could do what the customer is trying to do and it's not working. It's like, oh, cool, that's out now. That's awesome. Okay, let's go figure out why it's not working, right? So it's neat, but it is absolutely, it does bring some interesting challenges.
I agree. So, Vishwas, what's been exciting you these days in the Azure world?
This question is interesting because you have to always look at it from, you know, the projects that are ongoing, and then, you know, you have to work on, if they're Azure-based, and many of my projects are Azure-based, then you have to look at what services are being used. And then, you know, the regular course of development and then deployment and things like that. So services that we use today, you know, for example, we are using various database technologies today. And then you still have to, you know, if you can't take advantage for whatever reason, let's say you can't take advantage of Azure SQL database, and then you are running, let's say, the SQL Server on IaaS instance, and then you are thinking about SQL always on and those kinds of reliability capabilities. And then comes along something like Cosmos DB, which is, you know, designed for multiple regions in mind. And suddenly it opens up a whole new possibilities. And, you know, not only are you getting an SLA, on the availability of the service, but this is the first time you're getting an SLA on the read and write operations, so the 99th percentile or whatever. So, you know, that's the exciting part, being able to take advantage of these services and then have a direct impact on the project that you're working on. So that's been exciting, and that's sort of relatable to the project that you're working on. And then, you know, you have, you know, other services that come along that have possibilities down the road. You know, whether, you know, I know you're going to talk about machine learning and you keep looking at the new capabilities, you know, just go down the path of the cognitive services, for example. Of course, you have all these services and you further drill down, there's something called the labs. And there's some really interesting services there, which you probably did not imagine, and you have to explore them at some point and sort of bring that intelligence back into your application. So it's really twofold, Sujit, the answer. One is, what can you do to your current projects and how can you simplify the life of development maintenance? And then what can you possibly use in the future?
Correct, yeah. And that also, I think it's also incumbent on us to guide our customers, right? On, okay, these are things that can affect your bottom line going forward, right? It's not just some plaything that you, it's not some kind of shiny object that we're just, you can actually do something that has a good business impact. It's a different model, a different way of doing it, but you could have a good business impact if you tried some of these additional services.
Yeah, when I talk to customers or internal people, like the first thing I tell them is architect what you want, right? Don't put a technology in, decide what you want, you know, functionally, and then go look at the services before you write a single line of code, because chances are there's huge chunks of your application that you can just, yeah, you know, maybe you have to go learn a new service or learn a new, you know, feature or product, but now you don't have to worry about anything other than maybe one line of code to call that service, right? Versus writing, you know, who knows how many thousands of lines of code to reproduce the capability. There's just so much opportunity for that. I recommend people go look at that before they write a single line of code.
Yep. Very right. That's very right. And so Vishwas, you started talking about machine learning and things like that, and you know, I was hoping that we could have a discussion on that today, in the area of AI, machine learning, deep learning. I think those are the hot buzzwords today for sure, and I think those are services that a lot of our customers can relate to them, right, and take advantage of them once we understand how to use them. But I just want to set the kind of stage first. A lot of these people use these terms quite interchangeably sometimes, you know, like AI, ML, etc. And can you kind of clarify it for us and for our listeners? What is the difference between AI and ML? And then we can kind of go into what Azure services are available that offer those kinds of functionalities.
Sure. Artificial intelligence or AI, you know, it's sort of the broader category of intelligence exhibited by machines, right? It's that big field of machines being able to mimic cognitive behavior exhibited by humans. And what is interesting is, as the machines have gotten better, we have gone on to say, well, this is not really cognitive. You know, if you look at a few years back, being able to do text-to-speech well, or being able to do some image processing well, was considered, if you could do that, that would be AI. Well, that's, you know, that can now be done using, a subset of that, which is the machine learning. So think of AI as sort of the broader category of things that machine can do that mimic the human behavior. And machine learning you can think of it as a subset of that, where you are essentially developing programs based on observing the behavior. So it's not human intelligence-like behavior, but you are, let's say, in imperative programming, and the classic difference between regular programming and machine learning is, in imperative code, you're a developer, I come to you and you want to write a program, I give you the requirements, and then you develop some sort of a pseudocode and then you write that program. So that's imperative programming. In machine learning, rather than you write imperative code, I give you data about what should be the input, what should be the output. And then you have a collection of algorithms that you can choose which one to use, but that can mimic this behavior of, if I gave you this input data set and this would be the output data set, and please mimic this behavior. This ability of a machine or an algorithm to mimic this behavior is what is machine learning. So it is a smaller set of the bigger field of artificial intelligence. And then you didn't ask me this, but let me just extend, because these three things get talked about often together. And then comes sort of the deep learning, right? So what is deep learning within machine learning? So deep learning is a specific area within machine learning where you are developing sort of the multi-layer networks to deeply analyze the data using some network. And we'll talk more later about neural networks and things like that. But it's a very specific field of trying to learn behavior by deeply understanding a data set.
I see. So that takes it to another level, because now you're not really telling the machine or the computer or the program, oh, these are the set of data that I want you to mimic them. It's like, oh, go figure out what kind of data you can mimic, right? You're actually asking them to figure that out.
That's
what you meant by deep learning. Okay, that's interesting.
So when I'm thinking about, I do some, personal app development and, some things for my organization as well. And I think one of the things that I'm struggling with when we talk about this machine learning and deep learning is I keep hearing that there's, all kinds of possibility, everything out there. where does someone start? Like, what would you recommend on the, you know, to go? Is it start with some of the, you know, the cognitive type services where it's, you know, sentiment analysis or image analysis, like some of those things that are out there? Or do you recommend kind of jumping to more some of the freeform ones, because then those are maybe more generalized solutions? Right? Where does someone start if they want to make their app or their, you know, their business solution smarter?
That's a great question, Evan. So, you know, in order to explain that, you know, let's just talk about, you know, at the build time earlier this year, Microsoft reorganized a lot of these services into what they call the AI platform.
Yep.
And, you know, the AI platform is comprised of sort of four different services. And I'm trying to still trying to answer your question that, you know, how do you start?
Yep. Right.
So if you look at the, and I really liked the way, you know, how they structured this AI platform, because before that we had these services and you had a real difficult time sort of deciding where to start. So if you look at the AI platform for developers, and I think you can get to it by Microsoft.com/AI, and, you know, that's an easy place to go to. Then you have four categories there listed. Okay? The first one, of course, is the cognitive services. And, you know, this is where you get things like the Vision API, the Face API.
Right.
You probably use the video indexer. So yep. Very, very low barrier to entry. You essentially subscribe to an API, get an API token or whatever, and then call an API. And I'll give you an example. You wanted to, let's say, you know, I was helping somebody in our HR department, and, you know, I saw them, you know, just tallying up these expense reports and, you know, taking a bill in one hand and making sure it matches, you know, the expense report. I know there are some SaaS solutions out there which we are looking at, but we just hadn't done that automation. So I just to show them what was possible. And I said, here, let's take the receipt, you know, picture of the receipt, and let's call a Vision API, and the Vision API comes back with a JSON file that tells you, you know, what is on that receipt, right? And you know, somebody has filled out their expense report, and you have the data that, you know, on 13 September, they took an Uber for $20, and then now you have this data in JSON file. You can correlate the data, and now very easily you've built, you know, within a few hours just using this API, and then you, assuming you have a JSON file, you've written a program to match these things together. So one easy example of how Vision API can help. You know, another example I could take is the video indexer. I don't know if you've tried that. So video indexer, you might have. So video indexer is you take a video and you upload it, and then it does all the text-to-speech. Also, it does image recognition. So you can say, please take me to the location where this person appears in the video, or this got mentioned in the video. So you can do really powerful things with the cognitive services. So that's one. So let me pause here for a second. Am I answering your question?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's the ones that I think I kind of have a reasonable grasp on. Because if I have a scenario where I need to, you know, analyze video, analyze image, analyze, you know, text, right? That's there.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that's kind of what you were getting at is those are single use is probably not the right word, but they're kind of scoped to a scenario, right? I'm sure there's a ton of complexity underneath it, but the surface area of those services is pretty small, right? I give it an image, I get back JSON. I give it a video, I get back an index, right? And so I think that makes perfect sense. So I think it sounds like where you're going next is kind of that next level of thinking, which I think is where I'm personally stuck a little bit.
So yeah, let me extend this further, and then I'll pause to see if I'm answering your question. So, you know, up until now, you had this Vision API where you send it a picture, it gave you back some information about the picture. What if you wanted to build a custom Vision API, right? So, you know, I recently wrote a blog post about, you know, this project never came, but, you know, somebody had, you know, talked to us about this, and then, you know, this got me thinking. that what they wanted to do was they wanted to fly drones over neighborhoods and, you know, take pictures of rooftops and then figure out what type of roof it was and then was there a damage to the roof, right?
Yep.
So if you wanted to do that and if you wanted to have a sort of a low barrier of entry, at build time, there was this addition to this cognitive vision API called the custom vision, where you could upload a set of pictures to train a certain algorithm and say, you know, this is a roof type of type A.
Like here's good a picture or of bad type or whatever.
Good and bad. Okay. Yeah, yeah, exactly. So you know, as small as 60 images of different types that you can upload. And now you have customized. Once again, the experience is the same. You still have the API. You still have the API key to call, and you send it an image, and it classifies that image and calls you back with the information. But now that algorithm has been customized to your domain. So now we are talking about one level up from, you know, hey, I've given you a picture. You can tell me the age or you tell me the sentiment, but that is based on a generic data set. But now please train the algorithm on my specialized data set. And that's where the custom APIs come into the picture. Okay.
Right.
So that's one level up. And Evan and Sujit, I should, before I go too further along, I should say that, you know, I am a developer, an application architect or whatever. I'm not a data scientist. This is an area of great interest to me. So I try to study it, but I can't claim to be a data scientist. But I think that as developers, we have a very important role to play because, you know, a lot of these algorithms have been developed by data scientists. And then many of these algorithms are coming from Microsoft Research, for example. And really, complex algorithms that can do fantastic things. And this is not what developers, certainly not me, are trying to do. You can teach yourself enough math and teach the formulas behind it to appreciate how these algorithms work. But I'm certainly not sitting down and trying to develop these algorithms. But I think where developers can come into play, and goes back to your question, Evan, is being able to understand these algorithms and being able to apply it to a problem, to an application that we are building. So I think that's an exciting area for me personally. So I just wanted to say that because if my description of a certain algorithm is not 100% accurate, I just wanted your listeners to know.
I won't catch it. I'm in the same boat you are. I mean, I get the math and I kind of recognize what's going on, but to develop it, no way. That's not my not my expertise. So I'll trust you.
So going back to your question, which was a really good question about how you think about taking advantage of these ML services and building intelligent applications. So we talked about cognitive services. We talked about custom cognitive services. The next area is, can you in your applications, we have different styles of user interface, whether it is voice or UI. Can we sort of build an intelligent conversation based, and which we often call the bots? You know, can we incorporate some sort of a bot capability, which is also known as conversation as UI? And can our consumers of our application, communicate with our application through a conversation? And can we do the natural language processing? Can we figure out what the intent? Because somebody may ask you a question. I want a quote for the car. Somebody else may say, I want my insurance policy. Somebody may say something else. They all intend to apply for a quote. So how can we do natural language processing? And then how can we, in an automatic manner, reply to these? And furthermore, they may come in through Skype, they may come in through Facebook, they may come through Cortana or Alexa. How do we enable those scenarios? So, the key component here is something called LUIS, which is the Language Understanding Intelligence Service, which is a service that can give you this natural language capability. So you can come in and define these phrases, define these intents, and then when somebody comes in over one of these channels that I talked about, it can tell you what the intent of the caller is. And then you can use things like the bot framework to have the bot framework can, you know, look at the intent and then invoke maybe some sort of a business function that you've implemented internally through a web service or something like that, right? Azure function or something like that. So that's the next level up. And if you've not been following sort of the bot revolution, if I can call it that, it's really, really becoming important. And you know, consider this scenario, right? You go to you know, I read this example somewhere. I can't remember where I read this, so I can't give them credit for this. But imagine this scenario that you go to a baseball game, and you know you go, you know, find the seat, and you sit down, and just as you sit down, the game is at an important takes an important turn. You don't want to leave your seat, but you do want to get something to eat and something to drink, and you don't want to leave your seat, right? At this point, you have, you know, either you try to bring up their website, which may be too slow in the stadium, or you may want to download their application, and you know, which again will take you away from watching the game. And this example, this which is quite possible through the bots, is maybe there's some sort of an ID or a indicator right on the seat. You point your bot to that image, and it automatically loads a context-specific bot. Maybe the bot, you know, being made available by the folks at the stadium, and the bot comes up in your common bot framework, and you say, hey, I need to order this and this just through a text message. And they say this, and you know, the framework or the app under which this bot is loaded already has your information, has your credit card information. You say fine, and you pay them just through another text message, and soon enough somebody walks in and then, you know, brings the stuff that you ordered. So bots are becoming, you know, just look at what is happening with the Facebook Messenger and the bot platform, or they have a platform called Parlay, which allows you to build these dialogues very easily. So a lot is happening in that space. So that would be the next level up. Okay, does that make sense?
No, it does. Yeah, it absolutely does.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've been looking at a bit of bots these days as well, and for sure, I like the way how they, you know, some of the patterns that they provide on the bot framework or using bots or developing bots, I should say. The whole intent is to minimize the number of clicks or letters or, you know, any input that the user has to give, right? The what's the least amount of input we can get from this user and still understand what they're trying to do, right? And provide them with all the information that they need so that they can make an intelligent choice, but not having to type anything or type too much.
And you know, it's a combination of typing and maybe touch, because you know your bot sends you some sort of a data card,
right?
That all you have to do is a push-up button versus typing something, yeah. Right? So that's really and you know, having something like a you know, bot framework, I think the real value is, and you know, I was at a meetup, I think the August meetup, we, you know, it was about citizen services in Azure, and you know, one of the demos that we had was developed an Alexa skill. Which was then, you know, the way you write an Alexa skill is, you know, have to have some sort of an API that your skill can call, and that API was hosted on Azure Gov, mm-hmm. Right? And you know, the question came up, and you know, this was a citizen services demo, so you know, this is an Alexa skill where, hey, you ask Alexa for some imagine you want weather alerts, right, in a certain state, and you know, you can go deeper into this conversation and get the information that you're looking for. Somebody said, what about Cortana? What about the other digital assistants? So you don't want to bake in that conversational intelligence into every single channel. Instead, what you want to do is you can bring the device of your choice, but bake in that conversational intelligence into something like a bot framework, and then you can have these channels coming in. So makes it a really broad platform that you can address a wide range of devices and reuse the conversational logic from one location. So that's a very powerful capability, very interesting. And then we've talked about cognitive services, we talked about the bot framework, and then comes, we talked about deep learning a little bit earlier. So, you know, the best way to sort of explain this is, you know, the cognitive services has this face API or recognition API, which, you know, show it a picture and tells you who it is, right? We call that class of problem object classification. But then what if we wanted to do something deeper than that? What if you want to do object detection? And there was a very nice demo at Build. I'm sure many of your listeners saw that, where they had a shop floor right on the Build stage. And it was, you know, there were a couple of people working on that shop floor. And there was this machine learning algorithm, which was not object classification. It was just not recognizing who you were, but it was detecting objects in that frame. And this is a far more difficult problem of detecting an object versus classifying someone in a picture, right? Because, you know, once you have an object detection problem, imagine breaking up a picture into multiple regions, and each region could have a different object, and to be able to detect it is a difficult class of problem. So if you wanted to do this, then you, right today, you may have to, go down to a deeper framework. And this is where deep learning comes into play. And Microsoft's offering here is something called the CNTK, the Cognitive Toolkit, which is an open source toolkit, which allows you to train these deep learning algorithms without having to write a lot of complicated code, you know, because deep learning is about, multi-layer, and that's why deep, hence the term deep. It's a multi-layer network that ultimately is taught to mimic a certain behavior. And the way it is taught to mimic a certain behavior is that at every layer you have these weights, and then you adjust the weights to mimic this behavior. And how deep this network should be, it really depends on the class of problem that you're trying to solve. And if you had to program all of this by hand, and you had to sort of manage the complexity of
forever.
it would take forever. And yeah. Then there are these are really involved concepts, like you're training this deep neural network, and then your algorithm may get stuck in, let's say, a local minima, and you can, in that case, you want it to not get stuck, because that's not the ideal behavior that you want to mimic, and you want it to come out of that. You have things like changing the momentum when you're training this algorithm. So this is just one example of kinds of things that data scientists would do to, fine tune their neural network behavior. So imagine trying to write this versus, this toolkit, CNTK. You essentially define the behavior of your neural network in a configuration file. And then essentially, that toolkit does the rest for you. It reads it from the configuration file. And then, it is designed to be, it can run on a GPU, of course, but it can take advantage of, as you bring in additional GPUs, it can, parallelize itself and things like that. So, equivalent to what your listeners may be familiar with, like the TensorFlow. And you can go out and read about the differences between the two and the pros and cons. So if you wanted to do that, so to bring our example to a complete circle, so I was talking about object classification, and if I just want to do that, I would just call a face API perhaps. But if I wanted to do an object detection, then Perhaps I'll take an object detection algorithm, and there are examples in CNTK about object detection. I'll take one of those examples and then run it on my data set, and then do object detection in that manner. So for a heavy lift kind of problems where you are trying to do some deep learning type application, then you can drop down to CNTK. So that's number three, right? So let me pause here for a second. Does that make sense?
No, it does. It helps a lot because it again, I don't, it sounds like, I don't know that I initially have applications for this on the top of my head now, but going back to what we were talking about earlier, right? Understanding these layers, now when I see something, I kind of have I have a better sense of which tools, which services exist out there to let me do that, right? Which that's the starting point, right? That's the key part.
That's right. Let me provide you another example, which is probably more approachable to many of your listeners, right? I've been interested in this area generally of machine learning for, I would say, about two and a half years or so. And, of course, you read about machine learning in healthcare, you read about driverless cars, you read about all these cool applications. But as a software developer, I've always been thinking about, how can we apply machine learning to improve how we build software, right? How can these techniques help us? And if you go through this machine learning literature, there is not a whole lot about that because, people wanted to solve all these interesting problems. I want to do this disease detection or I want to do something else, right? But there are some articles that talk about how you can apply, and I'll send you a name of a book which talks about applying machine learning to software development. And, I picked up a couple of examples from this book and tried to implement it. One of the examples was that, what if you had a complex piece of legacy routine, let's say some sort of a mainframe algorithm, right? You have no source code available for that. People who worked on that have long gone. Nobody is willing to touch that, and there are no requirements documents or they're outdated. Can I just, take that piece of legacy COBOL routine and pass it, lots of input parameters, get the output, and take this large collection of data set and then maybe train a neural network to mimic the behavior of this legacy routine, right? that's one example. And this is an example from this book that maybe you don't want to put that neural network that has been trained to replace it, but imagine the possibility of being able to do all kinds of testing with this.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Yeah. It can really mimic the behavior. And I'll give you one other example that I used recently. So, we work with a customer, they're a large Azure customer, and of course they watch for where the money is being spent. And, they have this Power BI report that they look at very carefully. And they go get the rate card data and the billing API data, and they combine it with sort of Splunk data to find your CPU utilization and sort of combine those two and see, are we spending the money wisely, right? So they look at sort of what are the top 10, services that we are paying for any given month, right? So that's well and good. You should, of course, be monitoring that. But then somebody pointed out that, what about sort of the low grade fever problem that may exist in your system, right? So you may not be watching for a service which is maybe costing you $500-$600 a month because it's a service that you don't use often. But then something happened that this month it's all of a sudden started costing you $900, right? You will not notice that because you have a much bigger bill. But then there's something going on there. I was looking at this problem. And what I did was I took the data for the last 30 days and passed it to an anomaly detection routine. So, it is one of the algorithms that Microsoft makes available on the gallery. you can essentially, once again, you know, subscribe to that and call it. So what I started doing was, you know, get the nightly data from billing and rate card API and take these services, take this 30 services and send it to anomaly detection. And it sends back that something is happening with this service, which is an anomalous behavior. And sometimes, well, yes, that is right. We just changed the setting and, you know, 500 to 900 jump is to be expected. But in some cases, somebody made a change and you know, that change was not detected until 6 months. And now it's a difference of a $3,000 bill. So, you know, applied that. And, you know, humans are not good at sort of going and detecting those kinds of things, right? You know, you will look at the big numbers, but you will, if you have to do this every day, I guarantee you will miss that $500 to $900 jump. And then by automating this and simply calling this machine learning algorithm and having it notify you what that anomaly is. And at that point, you don't have to do anything fancy. All you have to do is send an email to say something is going on, please check. If it is valid, leave it alone. If not, take some action. So a couple of examples of things that we can do, you know, combine it with some sort of a DevOps. And, you know, you are doing automation, but, you know, by sprinkling in some amount of machine learning, now you're doing sort of smart automation as part of your DevOps journey.
That's a very good example.
Yeah. It is, and now I know why, you know, our profit next month is going to be low. Fishwash has given everybody all, you know, all the customers the look for the anomalous bill, and there goes all of our
Evan, that's a good point, but I have to say this, that, you know, if they're using their Azure bill wisely, they will be more productive with it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, totally. Oh, I would rather every day, you know, have somebody pay us less and end up getting more value out of it because you're more likely to stay, you're more likely to use more, you're more likely to get, you know, continue working with us, right? Then, yeah, it's absolutely not the short term. It's just funny. I just see this vision of like my, you know, the counterparts in finance and Microsoft, their hair just standing on end when they, you know, when they hear this podcast.
So I've just ensured that I don't get invited back.
That's not the case. You're always welcome back here, Vishwas. That's really good. I like the way you laid it all out, and you kind of to Evan's question, how you can get into this, right? What's the step by step process you should go through to figure out which Azure services or APIs, SDKs, etc. you should use. That's really
you
cool.
know, Sujit, I'd like to just give you one last example, and I think it's really important for your listeners to, you know. So I was working on a machine learning project for a government agency, and you know, the idea was that, you know, they have these policy analysts who you know, look at these news articles from hundreds of sources, and you know, they look at this information, and, you know, these people are assigned to work on a specific area of the world. You know, you might be an East Asia policy analyst, so you want to look at stories from there. But then there are hundreds of sources, and then there'll be multiple people in your group, right? And you know, the idea was, can we use some sort of a machine learning algorithm to sort of recommend them stories and then take into account when they go in and say, you know, I like this story, then we automatically take them into account because, you know, you two are working in the same policy desk. If it's of interest to you, then we should show you the story as well, right? So this was the problem. And you know, we picked this problem because it was based on public data sets. So even though it was a government project, you know, we could use something like an Azure ML service, which is not yet available in Azure Gov, for example, right? And we did this, right? And we used, you know, an algorithm called the Matchbox Recommender algorithm, which is one of the many high quality algorithms that are available to you directly within Azure ML. Right, so we used this, and then we started looking at the results, and the results were not quite, you know, they were helpful, but you know, we got this feedback that, you know, some of these stories didn't make sense and things like that. So we thought that we needed to change this algorithm, and we looked through all the other algorithms that were available in the Azure ML Studio, and we couldn't find anything else. Then found that there's a gentleman named David Bly. He was at Princeton earlier. I think he's at Columbia now. I know he's not at Princeton anymore, but this algorithm he developed when he was at Princeton, right? And this algorithm was about sort of, you know, taking a piece of text and trying to figure out, you know, what are the key themes within this text? You know, that's what the algorithm does. And you know, they have some very smart ways of determining what is the key topic area. And he developed this algorithm because, you know, millions of documents were unclassified. And you know, these digital historians came to him and said, you know, I have these millions of documents that have been declassified. Please help us run this algorithm and figure out what are the key topics that they were talking about so we can zoom into the right topic, you know, without having to read each one of them. So I had read about his work. He had made that algorithm available as open source R package, right? So got hold of that algorithm, and Azure ML, you know, of course, gives you a bunch of standard algorithms, but then it also allows you to bring in a third-party R package, in this case, David Bly's algorithm. And then we ended up using this algorithm, which produced better results. So, you know, maybe since we were not data scientists, maybe it took us a while to figure out what the right algorithm we should have been using. Maybe somebody who had a data science background would have had a better intuition than we did. But then this ability to you know, go find, and there are places you can look for these algorithms and what is a leading algorithm, you can go find that. And then if, you know, if it is R or Python or something else, you can take that package and run it as part of Azure ML and then take advantage of that to make your application smarter. So that's very much in the vicinity of what developers do every day.
That's cool. Yeah. That's very, very cool. Yeah, that's, I like that last one.
I mean, you're taking the power of the specialist, right, the data scientist of the world, and combining it with the platform, which really doesn't care what algorithm, but provides all the framework around it. That's an amazing way of combining the best of both worlds.
Yeah. And we should mention the Azure ML or ML Studio, right? Is that what they still call it? The whole canvas and things like that. I mean, that thing is just amazing. I mean, I think everybody has to spend time in that at some point.
Yeah, it greatly simplifies. We didn't even, you know, and I certainly don't want to extend the duration of this recording, but, you know, back to Evan's question, we really talked about three areas, right? We talked about cognitive services, deep learning, and bot framework. What we didn't talk about is this whole host of services called the data and the analytics platform. You have things like HD Insight, you have things like the Azure ML Studio, the Data Factory, Data Lake Analytics, all of these services. So you have all of these complementary services which will help you process the data. You know, you bring the data in, you can analyze the data. So you have a whole host of services available to you there as well, which we didn't get to explore. Maybe a topic for future conversation.
We'll bring you back for the third time at this point, Vishwas.
assuming the ML story for detecting these anomalies in the build goes over smoothly.
Yeah, exactly. We'll wait and see. We'll let you know in a couple of weeks, and we'll go from there.
But Vishwas, this has been really, really good. Yeah, I think, you know, you touched upon some really timely topics. I think everyone's been talking about these days, and this is just what we needed. I really appreciate you sharing your insights into this. And I don't know, do you want to talk about where you're going to be speaking soon? I know you're going to be having some speaking engagements. Is that something you wish to share to our listeners?
Thank you. You know, so Ignite is coming up in 2 weeks. I have two sessions there. There's a session on innovation with Azure Gov, where, you know, we often talk about VMs and storage and VNet and things like that, which is, of course, all of that is important. But this session is going to be focused on sort of, you know, higher order services or higher level services, which can help with the mission of these agencies. It's not just about running their data center, but, you know, things that we can do to assist with in accomplishing the missions of these agencies. So that's sort of a lofty topic. We'll see how that fares. Mm. That's one. And I'm doing this session or co-presenting with Steve Michelotti, who used to work at AIS, but is now a program manager in the Azure Gov engineering team.
Yeah, we had him on the show one time.
Steve is a wealth of knowledge, great presenter. And the second session is about ARM and compliance. So we've been working with the Azure Gov engineering team to build these ARM templates. So, there is obviously the quick start template, hundreds of templates that are available. You can go find one. But what we wanted to do for sort of the public sector agencies who are, interested in compliance like FedRAMP, and in order to accomplish this, you have to produce this documentation about the security controls and how you're going to account for those. And the idea was, can we from ground up, build these ARM templates that can comply with these security controls, and then by taking advantage of some interesting tagging and things like that, can we auto-generate some of this documentation? So that's one part of compliance. But then the second part of compliance is, you can have set up all kinds of policies. So, you can say that, hey, you will only provision this account, storage account, if you have encryption turned on. So, you have the concept of policies. Mm-hmm. And then, the third thing I was going to talk about in that session was what was announced recently. Because even policies come into play at provisioning time. So you're provisioning something and you may violate a policy. But then services like Event Grid, which Corey announced maybe 3-4 weeks back, something like that, where, the system is actually giving you these events about things that are changing in the platform and without you having to poll for them. So you don't constantly go and call this and keep querying this information. It's just the reverse of that. System is pushing these events out about changes to the things. And then, you can use Azure Functions or Logic Apps or whatever to make sure these things that you've provisioned continue to be compliant. So that's the other talk.
Yeah, sounds great. I hate that I'm not going to be there.
That's very nice, Vishwas. Thanks for sharing that. And, of course, thanks for all your insights today. I think you just, you can talk on any topic that's related to the cloud. I know that. So that's one of your key advantages.
Superficially, but yes. talk about these services, yes. So you've been very kind. You and Evan have been very kind to invite me back. I enjoyed this conversation very much, and I'm fortunate to have an opportunity to collaborate with Sujit at work occasionally.
So, yeah, we do meet up. We work with the same customer these days. One of his customers is the same as mine. So that is nice to meet Vishwa sometimes.
Cool.
Vishwas, best of luck with Ignite and all the other shows that you're going to be speaking at. And send us any information that you wish to share with our listeners. We'll put them in the show notes along with this podcast.
Sounds great. Thanks again, Vishwas.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Have a good night. Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle at Azure Podcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.